So, continuing our attempt to understand philosophy, you know, the thinkers who help shape yeshiva. So this week we'll move to the Rav, right? Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Joseph Dov, Shaber, whatever, right? Dr. Soloveitchik, right? Big Gadol. His biography is, you know, he's the scion of the Brisker dynasty. He's named for his great grandfather, the Beis Halevi, right? Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, whose son was Reb Chaim, right? His great grandfather, right? Whose son was. They use the same names, yeah? So then his son was Reb Chaim, who was the, right, inventor, as it will, of what we know, Big Adol of the Brisker Derech. Chaim had two sons that are relevant here. It would be the right Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, who's the father of the Rav, and Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, and Reb Yitzchak Zev, the Griz. Most of the dynasty of Brisk that's in Yerushalayim now are the descendants of the Griz. The YU Soloveitchiks are from the Rav and Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. The Rav, that's on one side. On the other side, he's a descendant of the Pershiner, of the Feinstein family. He's a cousin of Moshe Feinstein, though not actually from the Feinstein side, but whatever. Right, obviously, just in terms of basic genealogy here, the Rav had three children. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik is a professor at NYU. Dr. Atar Tversky, who married Yitzhak Tversky, who was the head of Jewish studies at Harvard for many years, and the Tolna Rebbe, and Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, right? Hence, Reb Aaron being the son-in-law of the Rav, right? So, Reb Aaron is not just his Talmud, he's a son-in-law, right? This is, so that's basically how we get to Gush being heavily influenced by the Rav. It's pretty straightforward. Right, the Rav, right, the Soloveitchik family, the Brisker family was, they helped found the Aguda. The Rav started in the Aguda, eventually moved to Mizrahi. That's one of the big moves in the Rav's life. It was very hard for him. The Rav writes about that a lot, but that is one of the things that makes him extremely important. He becomes the honorary president of the Mizrahi in America. At some point is offered and turns down the position as chief rabbi of Israel, runs for the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv earlier than that in the 30s. So that's one big move. The Soloveitchiks, if you know the Briskers at all from Yerushalayim, are hardcore Torah only. And the Rav's mother's family was less like that. And eventually Moshe came around, and after learning for many years basically with his father, he goes and to first to Warsaw and then eventually to Berlin, where he gets a PhD. in philosophy, also studies physics and math. That obviously also becomes very influential. And then the Rav's, you know, sort of influence on American Jewry can't be overstated. I don't know, it's not quite as much in South Africa, Australia, whatever, but in America, and he takes over his father's role as the Rosh Yeshiva of YU, of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. He also becomes the rabbi in Boston, founds Maimonides School, but really through YU, he has many, many, many students who become the leaders of the next generation. Their students become the leader of the next generation of Big Gadol, the modern Orthodox world in America. And then through Lichtenstein, that really sort of seeps into America, into Israel. And if you were listening to the eulogies at all, especially Rabbi Ariel's, where he was talking about how that was really a watershed moment for Israeli Jewry when Reb Aaron brought that world here. So his influence is tremendous. Yeah, and then we'll get to
What made Reb Moshe Soloveitchik diverge from the Nachari kind of
So Reb Moshe really didn't that much. Reb Moshe was a little bit, you know, he was convinced that for practical reasons it was really important for him to go to college. He started being affiliated with Zionism, maybe Eichshu, but the Rav himself was a member of the Aguda, and even when he applied to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in the 30s, he applied as a member of the Aguda, which is viciously anti-Zionist. The Holocaust was what really moved it for the Rav. The Rav is very explicit about that. And that was what pushed him to become a Zionist. A very different type of Zionist, not a Messianist Zionist. And that's, right, you've probably heard a lot of this at the eulogy. Okay, so his influence on American Jewry, I can't even begin to describe. And Israeli Jewry, right, insofar it's been influenced through his Talmidim, especially Aharon, it has become a force as well. So, with the Rav, I figured we can't just do one idea from the Rav, because you'll see how a lot of the ideas from the Rav in different books are very influential in our world. So we may have to take 2 weeks for this, since now I discover we have an extra week. So I brought a few of the Rav's books, right? Just a few. These are ones actually written in his lifetime, which is not true of most of the Rav's books. The Rav is the most prolific author to ever have lived posthumously, right? He wrote Rabbi Ronnie Ziegler, if you know him from Yeshuv, was put in charge of the Torah Harav Foundation. Basically, took a lot of the manuscripts. The Rav gave all his shirim from all his lectures, not shiryomi, but like his public lectures from he read off a transcript. So a lot of those, and a lot of his personal things that he never actually gave, and things he did give but never wrote up, they found the actual full texts, and from that, books and books and books have come out after the Rav passed away, right? Worship of the Heart, Worship of the Mind on Tefillah, and Family Redeemed, and Emergence of Ethical Man, and Abraham's Journeys, and whatever, not to mention all the stuff his Talmidim have put together. Pinchas Peli famously put Al HaTshuva together, which is based on a few drushes. There's another book on the other drush, I don't remember what it's called. A lot of books. Okay? And they've all been influential in different ways. So we're just going to go through some. If you want a summary, this book is helpful. It's a quick read. I read it on Shabbos. It's 400 pages, but 413 pages. Called Majesty and Humility by Ronnie Ziegler, by Rabbi Reuven Ziegler. Like I said, he lives on the other side of the Yishuv. He was chavrusas and roommates with Ruth Schreiber, going back forever. Their sons were born 5 days apart. The bar mitzvahs were the same week. They've been close forever. You can ask Ruth Schreiber. So he, when he was in Kollel, here, gave a series on the Rav, and that became the first half of the book, and then he added to the second half of the book and eventually published this. It's a very, very good book in summarizing the Rav's thought himself. There are many, many books of people analyzing the Rav's thought. This doesn't attempt to analyze too much, right? It tries just to figure out what the Rav said and not start applying it that much. Po Visham, he does have editorial comments like that, but he tells you when he's doing that and tells you when he's trying to analyze, but basically he's trying to summarize the Rav's philosophy. So, I don't know if you guys want to try to stuff this all into 1 week, or if we should extend it over 2 weeks, or see how it goes, see how much we get done, see how it goes. Okay, so I brought just 4 books with me. There are more. See which one we start with. Take your pick. Right? It's Halachic Man, Halachic Mind, Lonely Man of Faith, and Fate and Destiny, which is called the Dofek. What? Well, I'll go through what the topics are, okay? And you also see, by the way, how this, the Rav also diverges a lot from medieval philosophy, and I will highlight that as we go along. So, Kol Dodi Dofek was his speech to Mizrahi, which is one of his speeches to the Mizrahi, which really explains his position on Zionism. Halachic Mind, Beyond Dense, Don't Try Until You Have a PhD in Philosophy. But it's a very important book that describes the independence of religion epistemologically, and at the end gives his idea of Tamei HaMitzvos. Lonely Man of Faith is about the experience of faith in the modern world. Halachic Man is a typology of basically of a ideal Brisker, his father probably. A typology in the sense that it doesn't describe an actual human being, but it takes elements of a person and creates an ideal. Not an ideal as in, there are two, do you know what the difference is between the two types of ideal? Ideal can be like the best, and an ideal is pure, right? Like, so it's the ideal form. Like, if I were to take the elements and create a person who had no other parts to his personality, Right? That would be the ideal type. There are no ideal types. There don't have to be, nor should there be. Right? But that's an ideal. So that's this. There are other ones of Akashim Misham, which I didn't bring. Take a pick. Lonely Manifest. Okay. Lonely Manifest. So this is a... this was originally given to actually Jews and non-Jews. This is about the experience of religion. Not just of Judaism, but of religion in the modern world. A lonely man of faith is dedicated to his wife. To Tonya, a woman of great courage, sublime dignity, total commitment, and uncompromising truthfulness. Roy Ziegler suggests, and we'll get to this in a little bit, that the Rav here is going to talk about the intrinsic loneliness of the religious experience, and doesn't really provide a full solution of how one deals with that, but the implication at some point may be that if one were to find a spouse who really, really identified with him on all the important levels, that would some level alleviate the pain. So he argues that this attribution actually... What? That could be. So he thinks that that's actually fundamental to the book, which is possible. So Lonely Man of Faith. So Lonely Man of Faith starts off as follows. It is not the plan of this essay to discuss the millennium-old problem of faith and reason. Theory is not my concern at the moment. I want instead to focus attention on a human life situation in which the man of faith as an individual, concrete being with his cares and hopes, concerns and needs, joys and sad moments is entangled. Therefore, whatever I am going to say here has been derived not from philosophical dialectics, abstract speculation, or detached impersonal reflections, but from actual situations and experience with which I have been confronted. Indeed, the term lecture also is in this context a misnomer. It is rather a tale of a personal dilemma. Instead of talking theology in the didactic sense, eloquently and in balanced sentences, I would like hesitantly and haltingly to confide in you and to share with you some concerns which weigh heavily on my mind and which frequently assume the proportions of an awareness of crisis. I have no problem-solving thoughts. I do not intend to suggest a new method of remedying the human situation, which I am about to describe. Neither do I believe that it can be remedied at all. The role of the man of faith, whose religious experience is fraught with inner conflicts and incongruities, who oscillates between ecstasy in God's companionship and despair when he feels abandoned by God, and who is torn asunder by the heightened contrast between self-appreciation and abnegation, has been a difficult one since the times of Abraham and Moses. It would be presumptuous of me to attempt to convert the passional, antinomic faith experience into a eudaimonic, harmonious one, while the biblical knights of faith lived heroically with this very tragedy and paradoxical experience. All I want is to follow the advice given by Elihu, the son of Barachel of old, who said, I will speak that I may find relief, for there is a redemptive quality for an agitated mind in the spoken word, and a tormented soul finds peace in confessing. That's the introduction to Lonely Man of Faith. You will here note already a few central things that come up in the Rav's philosophy throughout, which are very important. Okay? First one is that the Rav totally and completely buys Kant's critique of metaphysics. Right? Immanuel Kant, right? The Rav was very, very, very well schooled in German philosophy, right? Specifically, his dissertation was done on Hermann Cohn's analysis of Kant. He identified the Marburg school of Kantian philosophy. Kant made one very important claim for our purposes, which is that the Rishonim, not just the Rishonim, the Greeks, everybody, focused on metaphysics because they believed, and we saw this with the Rambam, right? That you can prove God. You can know things in their essence, right? Kant said, no, you can't. You can't prove God. It's impossible. Right? I won't get into exactly why he thought this, but you can't prove it. Right? Because everyone goes into things with assumptions, right? Nothing can ever be quite proven in the actual logical sense, right? In the deductive sense, right? We spoke about this, right? The Rav accepts this, and therefore the Rav does not deal with metaphysics, right? Right? You see that already in this introduction.
So he accepts it, can't prove it.
Correct, right? Conclusively, right? And like a, you know, so he doesn't think there's any reason to be involved. Instead, he is involved in what's called professional theology. Not professional in the sense of amateur versus professional, but in the sense of profess, right? That he, the way he does theology is he tells you about his experience, right? As Ray Carmi once said, he describes in painstaking, beautiful detail religion, right? So that you, and then basically it's left to you to decide whether or not you identify with the experience that he has just described, right? That was the end, right? He is speaking to find relief, right? To, because he's a tormented soul, finds peace in confessing, but he's reading it so that you can identify with it, right? So that's the first thing that you have to know about the Rav in general. And this is, in the Rav in this sense is a very modern philosopher in the sense of the modern period, right? Where post-Kant, right? People, there's a move away from metaphysics of attempting to prove religion, opposed to describe religion in sophisticated terms. So that is the first thing you know about the Rav's philosophy. This is true, like I said, this is true about Lonely Man of Faith, this is true of Halachic Man, which, like I said, is a typology of a certain type of religious character, right? This leads to a move inwards, right? He describes the religious experience. Halachic Man is like that as well. Halachic Mind is an argument, like I said, towards the epistemic independence of religion. And again, this all comes from this notion of the Rav. The second issue that is critical, and this you should recognize from here, even though you didn't really hear Ravon speak that much, is that everything for the Rav, everything. Religion is full of
laws.
What? Laws, yeah, we didn't get to that. That's not what he said in the introduction. Contradictions. Right? Everything is on the one hand, on the other hand, right? Everything in the Rav is like this, right? Rabbi Ziegler argues, I think, compellingly, that there are several reasons the Rav is like this. One is the one you are familiar with, which is brisk. That really, that the Rav thought as a brisker in Gemara, in philosophy, in doesn't matter. Now, right? So everything is Hakira, right? But really, there are two types of Hakiras in philosophy that you got to know, and they're not the same. There's Hegelian dialectic, right? Hegelian dialectic has thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That every Hakira, in the end, right, yields a synthesis, right? Right? Achi yava kasav ashlishi v'achriya b'neihem. Right? That's Hegelian dialectic. Then there's...
Meaning there's one answer.
There's, right, there's contradictions which come to synthesis, right? Then there's Kierkegaardian dialectic, where both are really true at the same time, right? In a sense, experience, right? We start at the beginning of the year, I noticed that this year, right, this is an logical impossibility, P and not P, the law of non-contradiction, right? Right? Kierkegaard rejects this, basically, essentially, as does the Rav, not in a logical sense, but... Right, in the experiential sense, that you really are at both at the same time. I'll give you an example, right? Human beings talk about being something being bittersweet, right? Meaning they're happy and sad, which is really a way of saying happy and not happy at the same time. Now, logically, I could explain that this is not actually a contradiction. I could say I'm happy that I'm going to be in Toronto next year and be, the Skon Rosh Kollel. On the other hand, I'm sad that I'm leaving Gush, right? It's not the same thing. Right, but that's not how you experience it. You experience it as it's bittersweet, right? That
it's a combination.
Right, that you right. It's not combined. You actually feel both things at the same time, and they're in tension, right? That so in the world of experience, right, we could say technically there's non-contradiction, but experience doesn't actually work this way. You actually can feel dialectic. Right, so the Rav in different places sometimes deals with this type of dialectic, with Hegelian dialectic, which comes to synthesis, right? And sometimes with this. The Halachic Man, you'll see, is more this, Hegelian, right? Where there's a, Halachic Man is a synthesis of sorts, right? And then there's this, right? There's, right, so that you also see at the beginning. Now, this you, again, you see, first of all, in Brisk, right? It's basically a Hakira on life. We also see this if you talk to anybody here. You know, I assume if you ever heard Ray Carrigan talk, or you know, sometimes for Schreiber, but Ray Carrigan more explicitly, right, about the complexity of life, right, You know, on the one hand, and then right, not about Gemara, just the complexity of life, right? So that's very much influenced by this by the Rav. Okay? So now, the Rav is going to deal in Lonely Man of Faith with two senses in which man is lonely in the modern situation. One is... now, I'll just start the book so you don't think he's lonely in the sense that he doesn't have friends, right? He starts the book as, the nature of the dilemma can be stated in a three-word sentence. I am lonely. Let me emphasize, however, that by stating I am lonely, I do not intend to convey to you the impression that I am alone. I thank God do enjoy the love and friendship of many. I meet people, talk, preach, argue, reason. I'm surrounded by comrades and acquaintances, and yet companionship and friendship do not alleviate the passional experience of loneliness which trails me constantly. I'm lonely because at times I feel rejected and thrust away by everybody, not excluding my most intimate friends, and in the words of the psalmist, my father and my mother have forsaken me, ring quite often in my ears like the plaintive cooing of the turtle dove. It is strange, alas, absurd experience, engendering sharp, enervating pain, as well as a stimulating, cathartic feeling. I will also point out that you must believe that Rabbi Carrigan's vocabulary is also influenced by the Rav and Ravan's use of vocabulary. So he says there's two real reasons. Right? One is the objective loneliness of religion. Or that at some level, religion is, there's an element of religion that is deeply personal that can never be, right, that is never fully shared with another person. Okay? The second one is local to the modern man, which is that the philosophy of modern man is fundamentally opposed to the philosophy of religion. Okay? So that's where we're going to go to. That's really what Lonely Man of Faith is about. Okay? So Lonely Man of Faith is basically framed around a chakira. Right? Like everything else in the Rav. A chakira. Okay? But this chakira goes like this. Bracious Aleph and Bracious Bet. Right? As you might have noticed, if you ever read Chumash, there are two creation stories. Right? So, in the first Bereishis, we have a Chumash here. We have a Chumash. I have to read it from the Rav. Whatever. We all know that the Bible accounts offers two accounts of the creation of men. Right? So Bible predicts things, you know, whatever, two different traditions. It's not... So he says there's four differences between them. Okay? In Bereishis Aleph, right? Man is created, B'Tselem Elokim. Okay? But it doesn't say how his body was formed. Okay? In the second, he's dust, right? And God breathes his spirit into him. Okay? Yeah, that's one. Right, two is in the first one, his mandate is Milu Esar is Vichivshua. Right, fill the land and conquer it. In Bereishis 2, it's L'Ovda Ulishomra. Right, to guard it and to work it. Right, in the third Nafka Mina, so to speak, is in Adam the first, right? Male and female are created together. Right? In Bereishis 2, it's male and then female is created from his tzela. And the fourth, this is what biblical criticism has made so much of, was Elohim is the name used in Bereishis Aleph, and in Bereishis 2, it's Hashem Elohim. Right? So, the Rav proposes, how do we deal with the stira of Bereishis Aleph and Bereishis Bet? So, how would a good brisker solve this?
So, two aspects,
right? So just say dinim, right? Two dinim, right? Every chakira, right? There's a stira, you solve it with svei dinim. So, That's what the Rav does. And he calls this Adam 1, and this is called Adam 2. And here, the Rav basically says that this is, the two stories are telling you that there are two aspects to man. This, right, Adam 1, right, Adam the first, and Adam the second, the first man wants to be human, to discover his identity, which is bound up with humanity. How does he find himself? He works with a simple equation introduced by the psalmist to proclaim the singularity and unique station of man in nature. For thou made him a little lower than the angels and has crowned him with glory and honor. Man is an honorable being. In other words, man is a dignified being, and to be human means to live with dignity. However, this equation of two unknown qualities requires further elaboration. What must be right to answer this question? What is dignity and how can it be realized? The answer we find again in the words of the psalmist who addressed himself to this obvious question and who termed man not only an honorable, but also a glorious being, spelling out the essence of glory in unmistakable terms. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. So Adam 1 is the dominating man. Is the man who's born for greatness to dominate the world, right? He is godly, right? In the sense that he is a creator, right? And that's where we go, Elohim. Right? If it's selling Elohim, right? Elohim is God's name of force, of power, right? The first man is, right, created to conquer the world, right? Man and female is created together because there's no need for companionship, right? In here, right, the second story, female is created because human beings need companionship. Here, no. Man and female are created together. Right? There is no companionship. Right? It's just they're created at the same time. There are people. Right? Right? Their goal is, right, the Chivshua. Right? That's Adam 1. Right? He's aggressive, bold, and victory-minded. His motto is success, triumph over cosmic forces. He engages in creative work, trying to imitate his maker. The most characteristic representative of Adam the First is the mathematical scientist who whisked us away from the array of tangible things, from color and sound, from heat, touch, and smell, which are only the phenomena accessible to our senses, into a formal, relational world of thought constructs, the product of his arbitrary postulating and spontaneous positing and deducing, etc., etc. In doing all this, Adam the First is trying to carry out the mandate entrusted him by his Maker, who at dawn of the six mysterious days of creation addressed himself to man and summoned him to fill the earth and subdue it. It is God who decreed that the story of Adam the First be the great saga of freedom of man's slave who gradually transforms himself into man-master. It transcends the limits of the reasonable and probable and ventures into the open spaces of the boundless universe. And then he finishes, in sum, we have obtained the following triple equation. Humanity equals dignity equals responsibility equals majesty. Majestic man, Adam 1, power. And the Rav here finds religious significance, and this is very important for the philosophy of the Rav, in technology. Right, for the Rav, being technologically advanced is a kiyum in being Adam 1. Is a kiyum in Selam Elokim, in being, right, majestic man. Okay? That's, now, Adam 2, right, is religious man. Religious man, right, basically wants to create a relationship, right, with God, with people, right? He's submissive in that sense, right? He wants to give it, right? He wants to create a relationship with God. Therefore, right, if you look at the differences, right? He's created from dust, right? Which Adam 1 is not, right? Here, as I said, female is created because man needs companionship. Right, God breathes his spirit into him, right? It's not just that he is godly, but right, he has this relationship with God because his body is infused with the spirit of God. And his job in the world is not to conquer it, but love da l'shamra, right? To protect it, to maintain it. Right, so that's Adam 2. And so the Rav has this chakira, right, in Brachos Aleph, Brachos Bet, and solves it with Svei Dinim in the human being. One second. Let me see. Get a good summary here. Right. So if you know, If I had to, Rabbi Ziegler's summary. Adam 1 is on the quest for dignity, and Adam 2 is on the search for redemption. Right? Redemption is attained by control over oneself. Dignity by control over one's, not dignity over control, by control of one's surroundings. Right? Redemption expresses itself in surrender to God, dignity in defiance of nature. Redemption is characterized by retreat, dignity by advance. Right? Now the chiddush of the Rav, and not just saying that these two aspects to mankind, is to say that both of these are true and both of them are good. And the Rav goes from here and saying not only there are two types of man, which are both important, right? There's this, there's the redemptive man, right? And the majestic man. But there's two types of community. There's the community of majesty. And here, he says, this is where people don't have real relationships, right? Because your goal is to conquer, right? Relationships with people are pragmatic. Adam 2 is the community of faith. Redemption, right? Man seeks redemption. The man of faith is seeking a covenantal commitment. Right? And again, the Rav highlights this by this, right? That male and female are not created together. Female in the second story is created because man needs companionship. Now, again, I said before that classic to the Rav is that he has typologies. Just one second, right? Is that means he doesn't think that either of these exists pure, in a pure form. Right? These are typologies. Right? And all of us are Adam 1 and Adam 2. Now the Rav actually goes on to say that actually the chiddush of these is that Adam 1 and Adam 2 actually influence each other. Right? And every person is, right, that the spirituality, so to speak, of Adam 2 elevates the desire to conquer of Adam 1. Right? When you realize that God wants you to be Tzelem Elokim and to conquer, right, that brings you into the redemptive relationship with God, because now you are a commanded person who is following your command. Right? You're not just expressing your dignity, your majesty, but it's a response to the religiosity. Right? So, again, you see this classic in the Rav where they influence each other. These are typologies, right, which every person is a little bit Adam 1, Adam 2. Now, the Rav says that the relationships created in Adam 2, these are real relationships, because here, where you're not trying to dominate, you're willing to, right, be redeemed. And then the Rav goes on and says that the greatest relationships are created when it's not just you being receptive and being willing to give in to the other human being, but really when you have this, right? We have God, right, connecting the two people. They probably draw that wrong, right? Where the way you connect to other people is because you're both sharing in this attempt to reach God, and therefore you connect to each other, right? This is what he calls covenantal community. That since you're both in the same covenant with God, you connect to each other. Okay? So, if we wanted to summarize, the Rav says there are two typologies of people. There's majestic man who wants to conquer, whose relationship with other people is only pragmatic. His relationship to God is that he is godly in the sense of power. Then there's the man who seeks redemption. There's Adam 2, right, where he needs relationship with people and with God. He's not conquering the world, but he's developing the world. Right? God breathes his spirit into him. Right? They influence each other. In the second, Adam 2 is where we have covenantal man, right? Where you can create real relationships through covenant. And all of us are a little bit of each. Okay? We're good? It's a very powerful book. It's worth reading. Yeah?
So this is synthesis.
So this is a form of synthesis. Yeah, a form, and not quite. But yeah, now the Rav also has a whole bunch of things, right? Because here, we're creating a relationship with God. So he says, how do you create a relationship with God? Well, he says two primary ways. One is nevuah, which is God creating his relationship with us and us accepting it. Then there's tefillah, which is us initiating the relationship. Right? So that, right, he goes on throughout the book to detail exactly how the relationship developed. But yes, there is a constant dialectic. Again, I don't know whether it's quite this synthesis or it's the constant dialectic. Right? Rani Ziegler calls the chapter on this a perpetual dialectic. Right? Right, and then deals with the question of is it contradictory or complementary. He also knows there seems to be a stira in the Lonely Man of Faith, whether they're you're coming to synthesis or not. And suggests there's even a hakira within this, right? There's svei dinim of whether these svei dinim become synthesized or not, right? He suggests that Lonely Men of Faith actually presents both models. But again, we're not just getting a Lonely Men of Faith. But these are the basic ideas in Lonely Men of Faith, okay?
Just to go back to the relationship that you build with one another, is there any element of Adam 1 in that relationship between...
Yeah, right? I mean, once you have Adam 2, it influences Adam 1, right? Now, coming back to our question we started with, in what sense is religious man in the modern period more lonely than any other religious man? So here the Rav claims that the modern world, even the religious world, only recognizes this. Right? Therefore, every time human beings focus on this side of the equation, on redemptive man, they feel alienated from themselves. Right? Because he said that even religion in the modern world is, right, people present religion as, right, what's in it for me? Right? Ronnie Ziegler, to clarify this, right, says there used to be an ad in America that was very famous called "The Family That Prays Together Stays Together." Right? With an ad of a family going to church and then coming back and having a meal together and all happy. And the message basically was, be religious because it's good for you. Right? Not because you're in a relationship with God, but because it'll help me develop my family. It'll help me in my other relationships. It'll help me, you know, be successful and be smiling and, you know, have a good time. Right? Even religious people are drawn in by the Western world, which has elevated Adam 1 not just to one side of the dialectic, but to the only side. Right? So the Rav writes Lonely Men of Faith to explain not just the religious loneliness in general, but the unique loneliness of modern man who feels alienated from himself. Because at some level he's bought this story that everything is judged in terms of success, right? In intellectual success, commercial success, technological success, and even starts judging religion in this way. So every time he starts thinking in a redemptive, covenantal way, right, he feels like he's out of touch with the modern world.
And that's why relationships will help.
And that's why he's trying to profess his, right, Adam 2 experience so that to help modern man come to grips with Adam 1, Adam 2, as opposed to just Adam 1. Right? Now, just to finish off on Lonely Men of Faith, right, this is where Ronnie Ziegler points out that there seems to be, right, a lot of meaning to that which we started with, right? Because he says, Teutonia, a woman of, now listen to the words, right? Great courage, sublime dignity, right? Total commitment, and uncompromising truthfulness.
Sure.
Right? That the Rav seems to be implying at some level that if one were to find the person who they identified with in how they view Adam 1 and Adam 2, right, that could alleviate some of the spiritual loneliness that you experience. And his wife, right, had those qualities, right? Two from the list of Adam 1 and two from the list of Adam 2. Okay? Are we good on Lonely Men of Faith? Yeah? Again, you should read the book. I'm just trying to give you a survey here. But again, you should have seen a lot of the things and why I say the Rav, right, his presence can be felt throughout the yeshiva, right? This notion of dialectic, of the chakira in life, right? Everything being complex and very complex in the sense that it constantly affects itself, right? Being willing to embrace the modern world, right? But warning people of the dangers of embracing the modern world without allowing the spiritual perspective in. Right? All those elements come into play in Lonely Men of Faith. Okay? We're good? Yeah? You're all going to read Lonely Men of Faith now? Good. It's very short. It's really short. This is his most palatable work. Right? This was originally an essay. It's 106 pages. Right? This was a speech. It's not long. Right? I've summarized a lot of the issues for you. I've left out some details. But, okay?
It's an easy read.
Yechasi, by the Rav standards. Relatively. It's the easiest of the books. Okay? Let's move to this one, because we don't have that much time, so let's do a short one. Okay? Kol Dodi Dofek. Two main things I want you to get out of Kol Dodi Dofek, okay? First is, it's translated fate and destiny.
Are you not giving on purpose?
So the first is the sick nox. There you go. Right? The first thing that the Rav describes, really, I got three things I want you to get out of the book. The Rav here describes his move towards Zionism. Right? And the Rav describes that with the six knots. Right? He says, right, he was originally part of the Haredi world, of the world of the Aguda, who was anti-Zionist, but he then moved to the world of the Dati Lumi, to the Mizrahi, because he felt that God was knocking, right? He uses the mashal of Shir Hashirim, right, of the Raya and the Dod. Let's get the list here. So he says that what woke him up, so to speak, is the image of the Dod, the knocking on the door. And he said there were six knocks. I'll summarize them. I'll just read it right out of Ronnie Ziegler's book, because he took the main sentence from each of them. One was political. No one can deny that from the standpoint of international relations, the establishment of the State of Israel was an almost supernatural occurrence. Both Russia and the Western countries jointly supported the establishment of the state. Two, military. The small Israeli defense forces defeated the mighty armies of the Arab countries. Three, theological. All the claims of Christian theologians that God deprived the Jewish people of its rights in the land of Israel, and that all the biblical promises regarding Zion and Jerusalem refer, in an allegorical sense, to Christianity and the Christian church, have been publicly refuted by the establishment of the State of Israel, and have been exposed as falsehoods lacking all validity. Four, assimilation. Many of those who in the past were alienated from the Jewish people are now tied to the Jewish state by a sense of pride in its outstanding achievements. Many are now filled with fear and concern about the crisis overtaking the State of Israel. It is good for a Jew not to be able to hide from his Jewishness. The very fact that people are always talking about Israel serves to remind the Jew in flight that he cannot run away from the Jewish community. Five, self-defense. For the first time in our history of our exile, divine providence has surprised our enemies with a sensational discovery that Jewish blood is not free for the taking, is not hefker. Six, refuge. A Jew who flees from a hostile country now knows that he can find a secure refuge in the land of his ancestors. This is a new phenomenon in our history. Or the famous six knocks. Okay? I'm sure you've heard of these before. So a few points just to draw out, because you've all heard of this, is one, right? The Rav presents a Zionism, which is predicated in what, you know, the Rav and Rabbi Rabinovich in an article, and David Berger in an article, all, I think, said very nicely. The fundamental assumption of religious Zionism is that God, that history is meaningful, that God speaks to us through history. Right? That is the first point that is obvious from these six knocks. Right? Is that history is meaningful. Yes? The second, I think this does indicate very much the pragmatic Zionism of the Rav. Right? And like I said, one of the things that Rav Aaron introduced was a non-messianist Zionism. Right? You don't hear messianism in the Rav's Zionism. Right? It isn't. It's in many senses pragmatic, right? It's idealistic, yes, but not messianic, right? It's very, very pragmatic in that sense, and right, that is something. Right now, here the Rav Aaron was more of an idealist than the Rav was. The Rav, it's a lot. You hear a lot more pragmatism, and Ronnie Ziegler points this out in the book. But still, that non-messianism. Right, that Zionism, not founded on the Rav Kook notion of messianism, is very important. Okay, so that's very important. Okay, the six knocks, that's famous, right? Two more points that are important from the book. One is fate and destiny, right? How in at least one of the English translations is translated. The Rav here comes up with a beautiful notion that there are two covenants that we have with the Jewish people. One is the covenant of fate, and the other is the covenant of destiny, the Brit Goral and the Brit Yehud. Right? Fate is what happens to you. Right? Destiny is what you do. Right? And the Rav says that the relationship we have with other Jews is both. Right? One is the covenant of fate. The fact that the world treats us the way it does, and that we have a common fate, right? We all were killed in the Holocaust, right? If people are trying to annihilate Israel, they're annihilating us, whether we're religious, not religious, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, doesn't matter, right? We are bound together by our fate, by what happens to us. Right? That's one, that's a very real covenant, right? It exists on the human level, right? That we have fate, right? And it connects us to other people, that we have a shared fate. Right? Then there's the notion of destiny, which is what you do with that. Right? And here the Rav, right, says on a personal level, there's very little room for fate. Right? You should never view the world as this is happening to me, it's what can I do from here. But in terms of our relationship to other Jews, right, there's both. There's the covenant of fate, which whether someone agrees with you ideologically or not, you share, and then there's destiny. And here the Rav said, that here is where, in some level, we do depart, right? The religious Zionists and the secular Zionists do not share the same destiny, right? They're not identifying the same destiny, right? We are trying to create a religious nation, and they're trying to create a modern Western nation in the state of Israel, right? So the Rav, by creating these two britot, creates a language, a non-Rav Kook language, for how we relate to secular Zionism, right? The Rav Kook famously says that we relate to secular Zionists as tools in God's, right? They're holy tools of God, but they don't realize what they're doing. The Rav said, no, we are connected to Jews in two ways. And secular Zionists are sharing in our fate, right? Even if they don't recognize their destiny. Right? So he has this language of we're connected to all Jews in two levels, and even the most secularized Jew who denies the destiny of the Jewish people to be a holy nation and follow God, we're still bound together by fate. Okay? So that's one part of it. The other part is that this is the shift from fate to destiny. And like I said, the Rav thinks that for a nation, there's value in both fate and destiny. But for an individual, there's only value to destiny. You never ask the question, why did this happen to me? You ask, what can I do about it? Right? So now, remember we talked about theodicy, right? A while ago with Rabbi Yosef Albo, right? Suffering in Jewish thought. The Rav, and this happens many times in the Rav's thought, takes medieval philosophy, basically throws it out, and says, that was all an irrelevant question. Right? He says, okay, it's important at some level, but that's not the real question of religion. The real question of religion is not why, it's what. Now this he gets from Brisk, right? Rav Chaim used to say that the point of a chakira is not to figure out the... Not to figure out the why, but the what. In Yiddish it's the vos and not the farvos. The what, not the why. Right? Right? What and not for what. Right? Farvos. For what. And the Rav takes this not just as a principle in Lundus, but in theology. That our goal is to figure out what we are going to do, not why this happened to me. Right? Our goal is to transform faith into destiny. And the Rav starts this idea here. It's developed more in the collection of essays known as Out of the Whirlwind. But he developed this based on the image in Eov, where... Big Adol, he says, what happens in the story of Eov? Right, that Eov eventually, right, that he suffers. His friends all try to give theological responses. Eov eventually gets angry at God. And what does God say? God comes out of the whirlwind and says, where were you when I created the world? Right, do you understand the cosmos? And in that moment, Eov says, oh, okay, and returns to God, and God rewards him, and all is happily ever after. And the Rav notes that Eov, after these 40 prakim of all these theological back and forths, right, God's response is, you can't understand it. And Eov accepts that, and that's the end of the book. Right? He comes back to God. So I said, well, what's the message of Eov? And he said, the message of Eov is this, is that we cannot know why things happen, and that's not important. Right? So asking why we have the fate that we do is not important. And that was what God said to him. You don't understand the world. I do. Your job is to act. Right? Is to build based on that. Is to be is to react properly and to grow from any experience that I throw at you. Right? Your job in life is to transform your fate into destiny. Right? So, just to get the ideas that come out of fate and destiny, they're very important. Again, you see the chakira, fate and destiny, brit yud, brit garal. Okay, fine. Chakira and life, we got that. But here you see, first of all, the Ravs, right, by creating that dialectic, right, create a language for associating with people who don't share your ideology, right? They share your goral, your brit, your goral, but not your brit, right? Your fate, but not your destiny. He also, you see here very much his move away from medieval metaphysics, right? Asking whys and to whats. And this, again, fits very much with Brisk, right? We're trying to figure out what the halakha says. What do you do, right? Understand the nature of the halakha system, but not necessarily the philosophy behind it, right? And three is this pragmatism that comes through in Zionism, right? The six knocks, and they're very pragmatic, right? They're ideological in the sense that you see God, and you should see God in the world, and you should respond, right? You should act based on that, but it's not messianic, right? He's totally willing to say, right? There was this whole, explosion in Israel over Bibi inviting French Jews to move to Israel, right? And the Machane Tzioni said, no, we don't want to see people move to Israel just because they're being persecuted, right? And the Rebbe is saying, no, right? One of the ABCs of Zionism is that there's a place of refuge, right? That is inherently valuable. Pragmatism is important, right? The fact that we have a place to run to is spiritually important. It means that God is speaking to us.
So the Rebbe, according to the Rebbe's philosophy, you could be Zionist and then be Zionist.
Well, he did, right?
Yeah. But
and yes, and Ronnie Ziegler has a few pages on this. But yeah, the Rav actually at some point suggests that financing, right, being a philanthropist is a great expression of Zionism, right? Because you recognize you're being part of the right of the fate and destiny of the Jewish people, even if you're not here, right? Okay, I guess we're gonna have to stop with those two books for today. So to summarize. Right, what we did. Right, Lonely Men of Faith is basically an exploration into the nature of religious men in general and religious men in the modern world. The notion that there's majestic man who seeks to conquer and be powerful, and then there's covenantal man, redemptive man who wants relationship with God and with people. The relationship with people is created partially by that relationship with God. Right, central is prophecy and tefillah. These affect each other, right? And then I said there is a tension in the book, whether this is a Hegelian dialectic or a Kierkegaardian one, where they synthesize at the end or they don't, and maybe there's a Sveidinim in that, as Ronnie Ziegler suggests, right? There's actually a Sveidinim here. The generic aloneness of religious man is, right, that at some level it's personal, it's your relationship with God and not with other people, but also in the modern world, that the modern world only recognizes Adam 1, and right, so Adam 2 is difficult to even deal with at all. We saw through this, right, his general way of treating the world as chakiras, right, which highlights the complexity of life. Then we move to fate and destiny, where we saw a few things. First of all, pragmatic, non-messianism, Zionism. Also, his chakira, goral brit yud, which is a way that we relate to other Jews. By recognizing they can have one without the other. This becomes important for the Rav in other ways also, but also related to Jews in America as well. And also this notion of moving away from medieval metaphysics to pragmatism as a religious statement, that we don't ask why things happen, we ask what we can do about it, move from fate to destiny. And if you've been paying attention to people since you've been here, you should see how many of these ideas, right, this way of thinking of the world, the complexity, this conviction that we have to sanctify the world, recognize its value, but sanctify it. That we have to, right, not just live in a bubble, but act, right? How much of this, the pragmatic Zionism that you see, right, how much of this is influenced by the Rav? Okay, so that's Lonely Man of Faith and Fate and Destiny. I guess next time we'll do, Man of Mind. I don't know, maybe some others. Yeah, Yanni.
I'm just wondering, that Adam 2, the relationship with that spirituality, does that not lead more to like the angle of Chassidut?
There are elements of the Rav that are in some ways Hasidic, yes.
Because that seems very like Hasidic. The idea of relationship and my relationship with Hashem.
Well, no. I mean, it's not. There are elements of the world that are Hasidic. This one is not. The notion of sanctifying the world being a fundamental element is in many ways Hasidic. The relationship, not exactly, right? This is, right? Especially since in Hasidut, it's very non-individualistic, right? It's you connect to the Rebbe who connects to God.
Okay.
Right? Here it's very individual. Right? Every individual connects to God and Mimela can connect to each other. Right?
Oh, so it's through your connection with Hashem that you connect.
Yeah, I mean, it's more complicated than this because obviously the law of Dalish Shemra is very, very strenuous. It's not just about relationship, right? For the Rav, it's always about halacha, and we'll get more to that with halachic man. Okay, anyway, so that's two books of the Rav. We'll try to do halachic man, halachic mind next time.